Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Find our blog at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I'm Stephen Elliott, author, member of the San Francisco Writers Grotto, and founder of the Progressive Reading Series. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Naomi Klein, journalist, syndicated columnist, and author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. Her first book, the international bestseller No Logo, was translated into 28 languages and called a movement Bible by the New York Times. Naomi writes a syndicated column for The Nation and The Guardian and reported from Iraq for Harper's Magazine. In 2004, she released a feature documentary about Argentina's occupied factories. She is a former Milbrand Fellow at the London School of Economics and holds an honorary Doctor of Civil Laws degree from the University of King's College, Nova Scotia. Please welcome Naomi Klein. So maybe, Naomi, we can just start out with the basics. Probably half this room has already read The Shock Doctrine, but maybe for the other half that hasn't, what is it?
Well, what I mean by The Shock Doctrine is a political strategy. I'm referring to a political strategy that's been in use now for several decades. And the political strategy used to impose the brand of radical free markets policies that are now imploding before our eyes on Wall Street, deregulation, privatization, essentially a vision of society that sees the government as the enabler of corporate profit accumulation, not as the regulator or the setting the rules of the road, but really just putting economic growth above all else. So this is the Chicago School of Economics, the ideas most popularized by Milton Friedman, the undoing of the New Deal. We've been living this counter-revolution now since Reagan. And the Shock Doctrine is an attempt to explain how policies that are often very unpopular have been imposed around the world. And I'm arguing that in order to understand this, we need to understand the extreme utility of crisis, of profound crisis, in creating a kind of a state of emergency atmosphere where it becomes possible to push through very, very rapid free market policies. And I always put free market when I write it in quotes, because as we're seeing right now, the free market isn't all that free. There's a lot of intervention in it, but it's intervention in the interests of corporations rather than the interests of the broader society. So the Shock Doctrine is that strategy of using a crisis to push through very rapid fire free market reform, all in quotes, free market reform.
I want to stay on this just for a second. You mentioned the Chicago School, mm-hmm. and in your book, the Chicago Boys, or the guys that went down to Chile and other regions. Could you maybe go a little more in depth about that, about the Chicago School and their governing philosophy and the free market fundamentalism that you're talking about here?
Yeah. Well, I want to be very clear that this is really an alternative history of how we ended up with this deregulated form of capitalism, what the French call savage capitalism, and what in Latin America they call neoliberalism. I don't believe that this project that we've been living, this unmaking of the policies of the New Deal or developmentalism in the South, has been driven in any way exclusively or even primarily by ideology. By the ideas people like Milton Friedman. I think it's really been a revolt of the elites who were tired of dealing with the strong unions that won higher and higher salaries, tired of paying the level of taxation required to support large social programs like Social Security, or in my country, from Canada, single-payer national health care. And so it's been this unmaking process. What mm-hmm. Thomas Frank in his book, that's why he refers to this breed of Republicans as the wrecking crew, because this has been not a construction project, but a deconstruction project. So I want to be very clear that I think what's been driving this has been a desire for more wealth, and I think from the elites. And I think it's been an enormously successful class war waged by the very rich against mm-hmm. everybody else. That said, as part of that class war, it has been very important to have ideas. And this is something that Lewis Lapham writes about very well in Harper's and elsewhere, about how in the mid-60s there was this realization among primarily on Wall Street, but among this country's richest families, that they were losing the battle of ideas and that they had to start taking ideas more seriously. And as part of that, there was the funding of a great many think tanks and also the funding of the ideas of Milton Friedman, including things like the 10-part series Free to Choose, to popularize these ideas that essentially said if you liberate the elites, if you take down all barriers to the accumulation of profits, whether it's trade barriers, environmental and labor regulations, you will create the context for the best possible society. And it's an appeal to economics as a kind of state of nature. If we would just stop interfering, then you would have this perfectly balanced system.
You just need a free market.
You just need a free market. So the Chicago Boys are not a group of Americans who went to Latin America. They're a group of Latin Americans who went to the University of Chicago on scholarships. It started in Chile, where there was a concern at the U.S. State Department about the fact that Chile, this is in the 1950s, was moving to the left very rapidly, that socialist ideas were really taking hold, and certainly what's called developmentalism, import substitution, and that this was a threat to U.S. economic interests in Latin America. So the head of the State Department's Chile office and the head of the University of Chicago Economics Department came up with this idea of bringing groups of economic students from Santiago, from Chile, to the University of Chicago to study under Milton Friedman and his very radical colleagues in order to try to shift the political discussion in Chile to the right. That's the origin of the Chicago Boys. A lot of people think they're Americans because, obviously, the name would suggest. But, in fact, hundreds of Latin Americans went through this program. And Chile's a foreign minister after Pinochet, a man named Juan Gabriel Valdez, he did his PhD thesis at Princeton on the origins of the Chicago Boys. And he calls this a project of deliberate ideological transfer, which I think is a really interesting phrase to describe this attempt to implant these very radical ideas. Interestingly, ideas that were seen as radical in the United States, because this was the heyday of Keynesianism, and Friedman and his colleagues were very marginal at the time. But the idea was is that their radicalism would be the counterbalance to socialism in Latin America.
It's so interesting because, as you mentioned, they were these like marginalized figures, and they had these horns, which was weird. But, you know, you have this idea of, like, what good are ideas, right? I mean, they're just ideas. They're not guns. And yet you talk about in your book how it's not, with the exception of Iraq, it's not that we went out and destroyed things. It's rather that they created these ideas, and the ideas were there, and they were ready.
Well, yeah, and I start the book with a quote from Milton Friedman. He wrote it in 1982 when this country was in an economic crisis. And that quote is, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. And when that crisis occurs, the change depends on the ideas that are lying around, as you say. And then he says, that I believe is our basic function, to keep the ideas ready until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. So I spend a lot of time trying to zero in on the ideas that are lying around, because it's important to be ready for the next shock and understand what are the ideas coming down the pike.
Because the shock's going to happen. Shocks will happen.
We're in the middle of one, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the ideas are, privatizing Social Security, offshore oil drilling, drilling in Anwar. I mean, this is what this is what Newt Gingrich is gunning for. So much of what we're living through right now, it will become, I realize I'm kind of getting ahead of myself in terms of the discussion, but I mean, if we think about January, okay, and the way things are looking now, it would be a Obama presidency if things continue the way they are. I know we're not supposed to get cocky, but this economic crisis that is deepening will be the excuse that will be used to say to Obama and his supporters about all the things that they've been saying, yes, we can, about no, we can't. I mean, I know many of you watched the debates last night, and this is the way Obama really positions himself as a new era, as this that he says, we are entering an era where we're going to invest in people again, we're going to invest in infrastructure again. Well, if you read the websites of the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Republican Study Committee, Newt Gingrich's organization, they're all getting their arguments ready for why all of this is now impossible because of the economic crisis. And more than that, that what you need in an economic crisis is more tax cuts, eliminating the capital gains tax, offshore oil drilling, all of these things that will be the stimulus for business, and that any regulation is too onerous for them in a time of economic crisis. So this crisis, we are only in the first shock. There's lots of aftershocks to come, and we need to be ready for these strategies. And this is why I wrote the book. I wrote the book to help people prepare themselves for these tactics, which really only work if we don't know about them. Right? And what I show in the book is that economists sure know about them, politicians sure know about them, corporations sure know about them, but there hasn't been nearly enough popular focus on this very straightforward tactic of using the window of opportunity of a crisis to push through these very unpopular policies. Because these could also be opportunities for progressive change, but we need real confidence in order to seize them.
Two of the scariest examples in the book were Indonesia and New Orleans.
Right, the tsunami in Indonesia and Sri Lanka, Thailand, and New Orleans. Yeah, I start the book with the example of New Orleans. I was already writing the book when the levees broke in New Orleans and the city was flooded. And I had already come up with this phrase, disaster capitalism, to describe this phenomenon of seizing disasters to push through this radical brand of capitalism that actually includes the privatization of the response to the disasters themselves. Because this is what I documented in Iraq for Harper's Magazine. I went to Iraq on assignment for Harper's to try to find out whether this idea, the title of the piece was Baghdad Year Zero, Pillaging Iraq in Pursuit of a Neocon Utopia. Okay, and this was the first year of the occupation, and this was looking at what Paul Bremer tried to do in terms of seizing that window of opportunity after the invasion to push through the wish list, the Republican wish list, right? In fact, the FT described it as the wish list for foreign investors. It was 15% flat tax, 100% foreign ownership, all these policies that are really at the very extreme end of what they're able to accomplish in Russia, in Argentina, in the United States, i.e. they're not able to get through all of these policies at once. In Iraq, they were able to at least get them through on paper because there was no negotiation whatsoever. It was just Paul Bremer writing the laws and signing them into law. There was no negotiation because there was no Iraqi government. And this was the order in which things were done in Iraq. It was invasion, extreme country makeover, elections, right? It's important to focus on the Bush vision of democracy. It is so very narrow, right? That you go and you make all of these fateful decisions that tie the hands of any government to come, lock in contracts that will last up to 40 years, and then say you can vote now, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very, very thin version of democracy. And they pretended that this was apolitical, that this was just technical, this is just the way things are done. And that's a very Chicago school approach, this appeal to nature, this appeal to technocratic certainty, and really a disguising of a very, very ideological project with this technocratic language and technocratic discourse.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, it's a Chicago school because I grew up in Chicago, and we had a thing called West Side Economy, mm-hmm. and that was when they beat you up, took your money, and didn't give you anything. And so it's very, we just say West Side, and then we take somebody's money.
Well,
and
that's sort of what they did in Iraq on a massive scale, yeah.
It's weird, the way it all just kind of transcends.
Very nice. I'm going to use that, Stephen. But yeah, I mean, New Orleans is, I didn't really answer your question, but New Orleans was a domestic example of the same process, where immediately after the levees broke, and I went to New Orleans while the city was still partially underwater. I also went to Baton Rouge, where all the lobbyists were swarming, and did a lot of interviews with these lobbyists who kept telling me what a tragedy but great opportunity this was because of those housing projects. They were such a problem anyway, and now we're going to be able to get some condos in there and really clean up this city. And the most famous quote was Richard Baker, the Republican congressman, saying, "We couldn't clean out the housing projects, but God did." And, you know, I think it is worth focusing on that. You know, they went for the housing projects first. That was the top of the agenda. There were lots of other things, like the school system, you know, giving parents vouchers, charter schools, as opposed to rebuilding the public system. But the housing projects, bulldozing the housing projects, which they have done, was the number one priority in New Orleans for the so-called reconstruction, which was really a destruction of the public sphere, and because those housing projects sustained minimal flood damage. And, you know, it's really, to me, it's a question of democracy, because if people had been allowed to come back to those housing projects, to their homes, 5,000 families, then that's 5,000 African-American families who could have participated in the decision-making about what they wanted their city to look like. But they were kept out of that, and that was the opportunity. It was the opportunity to make decisions without the participation of the people those decisions affect.
The same way the fishermen were kept off the beach.
Exactly. And this, you know, this strategy, it's not about taking, you know, it's not about whether or not you take advantage of a crisis to advance change. Every crisis demands change. It's whether or not you take advantage of a crisis to subvert democracy and to concentrate power in the hands of the few. You know, think about Henry Paulson and his 2.5-page plan that said, "Give me $700 billion and don't ask any questions ever."
I wrote one of those, and like nothing happened. This leads.
But if I could just add one more thing about the housing, it's like, you know, this is why, in part, why we're in this subprime mess, because this government didn't believe in things like public housing, didn't believe in rent control, didn't believe in a lot of progressive ideas about how to get low-income people into decent housing. And I know the housing projects in New Orleans needed dramatic change, needed dramatic reform. But the administration's idea was to convert from a public model to a private model exclusively of home ownership, subprime home ownership, where you could have this kind of speculation that we've seen today. And it wasn't because they just thought ownership was better than renting. It's because that was such an incredibly profitable industry, and they were helping their friends on Wall Street.
I don't want to go to the questions from the audience, but I'm going to anyway because I was told I had to.
Mean anything by that, by the way. It's a huge amount of respect for your opinion.
I do. Yeah, I do. There's some very interesting questions here, and they tie in actually very well what you're talking about. And I thought before, you know, 1917, October 1917 strikes me as like disaster communism, you know. And someone is asking, can disaster socialism work? Or is there another way to stop disaster capitalism after a disaster?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, 1917, it's Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who, by the way, I hope will be the next Treasury Secretary. you know, I say that how about a Treasury Secretary who's not from Wall Street? How's that for a crazy idea? Joseph Stiglitz, who was a senior economist at the World Bank, when the shock doctrine was applied to Russia in the mid-90s, described the pro-corporate Chicago boy approach in Russia, and they often called themselves the Chicago boys, as market Bolshevism, because he was precisely bringing out the parallels between disaster communism and disaster capitalism in terms of using a crisis to push through policies that were often unpopular. But, you know, I think the best counterexample to this is the market crash of 1929 and the incredible progressive responses in this country and in countries around the world to the Great Depression. And I call that disaster populism. I know populism has been turned into a dirty word, but I don't think it should be. It just means that it's popular. And if we think about what was going on in this country in the 30s and the conditions that created the New Deal and that required FDR to continue to deepen the New Deal and add things to it and make it more progressive, it was that people were responding to that failure of the market system, to that disaster, through broad-based community organizing, labor organizing, neighborhood-based organizing. So many people were being brought into the political process. And so that it's really a counterexample to this undemocratic approach from whatever side of the political spectrum, you know, to take advantage of a disaster by concentrating power. If we think about what was happening in this country in the 30s, power was being radically dispersed. People were finding power through collective action, and that put that gave FDR the ability to sell the New Deal to the elites in this country, because the country was moving so far to the left. He said, "Look, if we don't give them something, they're gonna demand socialism. We're gonna have a revolution on our hands." And I think that's a very important historical lesson to learn, because we often act as if FDR just handed the New Deal on from above. And the right has really spread a lot of misinformation about the New Deal and often doesn't talk about those popular movements, but talks about it as a kind of, you know, liberal coup d'etat. And so those that people's history, you know, that Howard Zinn writes about, that Francis Fox Piven writes about, gets erased from the story. And it's so important for us to remember this now, looking at the possibility of an Obama presidency, because he's under a huge amount of pressure from above. And the biggest favor that Obama supporters can give him after the elections is to be that pressure from below that allows him to say, "Look, you know, I've got no choice."
You touched on this a little bit already. We have a question says, "With the crumbling of the U.S. economy on Wall Street, do the elites still want a radically deregulated free market?" And this is an interesting question, because we're seeing a real pushback on this philosophy. It seemed to me that both candidates are talking a lot about regulation, which is, you know, the opposite, it would seem.
They're talking about it. And the question is, are they really going to do it? Everyone's talking about it. And I think because they're talking about it, there's an assumption that it's actually happening, just because that would be the logical thing to do. Please don't assume that. Yeah. You know, if we think about New Orleans, what's most shocking about what happened in New Orleans is this was a disaster that was so clearly created by the abandonment of the public sphere, right? Those, you know, New Orleans was not drowned because of a hurricane. It was drowned because the levees were allowed to crumble. They were not repaired. The public transit system was allowed to erode. You had three levels of government that just didn't think it was their job to worry about the people in that city. And, you know, if we remember what we felt in that moment, most of us thought, naturally assumed, that this was going to lead to a correcting, right? I remember Jonah Goldberg, of all people, wrote this column saying, you know, okay, it's a disaster. You kind of want big government to ride to the rescue, right? Where's the big government when you need it? And it really did lead to a kind of a crisis for some people on the right, seeing the government that wasn't there, what Krugman called the can't-do government at the time. But, you know, what I'm documenting in the book is that it would have been logical to build up the public sphere in response to this clear failure of this ideology of deregulation. But if you go to New Orleans today, what you see is that they've actually just finished the job of destroying the public sphere. The housing projects are gone. Charity Hospital, the largest public hospital in the city that treats the uninsured, is still closed. The public school system has been partially privatized. So just because it makes sense, don't assume they're doing it. What they're actually doing in response to the financial crisis is cutting taxes, right? Remember that $118 billion that was attached by the Senate to the bailout bill So taking more money out of the government coffers at the same time as you're putting all of the stress on it. They're eroding mark-to-market accounting. They're loosening accounting rules because there's a huge amount of pressure coming on the Senate and the Congress for more deregulation. And the ideas that are lying around are get rid of Sarbanes-Oxley, the post-Enron regulations. So they still want deregulation. The other push is to suspend the capital gains tax because the financial sector is under so much pressure.
And because they're ridiculously wealthy, can't afford it.
Yeah.
It costs a lot to be rich.
So in terms of, what we have now is an opportunity to make very strong demands for real regulation of the financial system. But that is not what's happening. And they have, they're outsourcing the administering of the bailout plan. Okay, the first contract that they handed out was to a law firm that represents 7 of the 9 banks that just got the bailout. I mean, it's a stew of conflict of interest. The very same people who got us into this mess are now being paid to get us out of it, paid to take money to get us out of it. Okay, I mean, it's beyond. So don't. I mean, this is why I think Tom Frank's framing of the wrecking crew is really important because they're actually using this disaster to finish the job, and it means that. And the next administration comes into this hollowed-out house, and all of these, they inherit all of these decisions. So, they like certain types of regulation. This is why the idea of deregulation is a little bit too simple, right? Because it's what they like is to make a lot of money. I'm sorry, okay, mm-hmm. But I'm terribly facile, and I oversimplify these things, but. If there are certain kinds of regulation that really protect corporate profits, like protect 30-year protections on drug patents, right? And so you have these same corporate lobbyists who will fight tooth and nail against regulation of the financial sector will also be fighting very hard for the implementation of WTO rules on China and other countries to protect their intellectual property. So they like those regulations. So it isn't that they don't like rules. It's that they don't like rules that actually stand in the way of the accumulation of profit. They do like rules that help them in their accumulation of profit. So rules are important, and that's what free trade agreements do, and that's what the World Trade Organization does. So it isn't just deregulation. It's a particular type of deregulation, and they're still quite wedded to it. But, one of the things that's interesting and shows potential, like progressive potential for this moment, is we're seeing an international cooperation on quite an unprecedented scale with all these finance ministers and central bank chiefs coordinating a response to the crisis that is global in nature and needs a coordinated response. That opens up a really interesting prospect for things like the Tobin tax, which has been kicked around for many, many years now. This is an idea that was first developed by James Tobin, an economist who won the Nobel Prize, saying that you could tax currency traders. And the idea was to slow down the casino economy, but also you would have a revenue stream. And we have to think about revenue streams, right? We have to think about, the counter argument to no, you can't, we can't afford it, is that you have to think about new ways to get more money to the government, new taxes. So that's just one example of how there could be a progressive response in this moment.
You brought up the WTO. And the World Trade Organization, and I was also thinking about from your book from the International Monetary Fund. This is, fascinating that these organizations that are set up that, in a way, should be all about regulation have turned in to kind of the prime vessels for the enforced spreading of free market fundamentalism. So as long as you brought up the WTO, maybe you want to talk on that for a second?
Yeah, I mean, this is a moment where... I think we really feel the absence of international institutions that really act in the public interest in the financial sphere. And this was the original idea of the Bretton Woods institution of the Bretton Woods institutions of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the historical context. I mean, many of you know this, but the historical context was that after the Treaty of Versailles, after World War I. Punitive sanctions were placed on Germany that created a profound economic crisis, an economic shock. And Keynes predicted, as he left the Versailles negotiations, that this was a terrible mistake And he said, vengeance will not limp. And he basically was predicting the rise of fascism in Germany. And no one listened to him. Then the Great Depression hit, and that economic crisis in Germany, that humiliation in Germany, was deepened with a further economic crisis, and you had the context in which Nazism took root. After the end of the Second World War, basically Keynes, everyone recognized, had been right. And it was out of that realization that governments came together and created the Bretton Woods institutions. And the idea was to prevent any economy from ever being shocked like that again, going through such a volatile political crisis, economic crisis, not just because of the economic hardship, but because of the political risk, because it is really dangerous. And there was an understanding of that. The irony is that these institutions have been hijacked by ideologues. This is one of the things I show in my book, is how the Chicago boys didn't just go to Latin America. They went to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. They're enormously overrepresented at those institutions, and they used these institutions that were supposed to be stabilizing forces for the world economy to push their ideology and, in many cases, to deepen crisis. And a lot of the quotes I have in the book from economists saying, well, maybe we need a crisis in order to get these beneficial reforms, come from people at the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which is a terrible historical irony because these institutions are supposed to understand the risk of those shocks. I kind of wish that hadn't happened. I think that part of the problem, though, is the centralization of the institutions. That the message coming from the global south right now, from Latin America, from Asia, is that they don't think these institutions can be reformed in Washington. That really what's needed are regional banks that are responsive and more democratic to their regions. There can be coordination between regional banks, but that everything can't go through Washington and Geneva anymore. And so you have in Latin America the emergence of Banco del Sur, which is doing lending in Latin America. And after the Asian financial crisis, Japan proposed an Asian bank that would replace the International Monetary Fund in Asia. That was resisted, but I think that idea is going to come back now. The problem is actually that this crisis is really good for the International Monetary Fund. The International Monetary Fund was going out of business a few months ago because countries didn't want to borrow from them anymore because they didn't want these very ideological conditions attached to their loans. So they were loaning from each other, but also high commodity prices made it possible for countries like Venezuela and China to lend. But now, the latest report is that, you know, the IMF is really back from the dead, and so many countries are in trouble now that they're turning to the IMF. And so it is a moment to be talking about, you know, what making sure that they don't impose more deregulation in exchange for those badly needed loans.
So we're at the halfway mark already, and I'm supposed to remind our radio audience that we're talking with Naomi Klein, journalist and author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We've got about 100 questions here.
Okay,
pretty much everybody
giving
that showed up
answers.
Wrote a question, and we probably won't get to them, to all of them. We won't. We won't get to all of them, and it's not because I'm drunk with power. It's because there's so many questions, which is great because it means it's a really engaged audience, but I'm going to try to get to a few of them. Question for today's speaker. I am a student at California College of the Arts in San Francisco. Starting this semester, my college increased its already expensive tuition about 8%. Now corporate sponsors are being invited in to sponsor graduate-level design courses in exchange for relatively small amounts of money. Could you reflect on how this might be a form of economic shock therapy? The higher education thing, the college thing.
Well, I think, you know, this economic crisis, you know, this is only going to increase. That the crisis is being offloaded onto states and municipalities. Many of them have balanced budget ordinances, which basically forbid them to run up a deficit. So where's the money going to come from? More privatization, more corporatization, right? And it's going to come through corporate sponsorship of the arts, of education, and a selling of more public infrastructure. We're already seeing this pressure. Selling of roads, toll roads, bridges. This is often described as the next bubble. Now that the housing bubble has burst, infrastructure is what a lot of investors are excited about. What's interesting is that the people who are driving it are J.P. Morgan, Citibank. You know, it's the same group of companies that we're I think rightfully losing faith in. So it is once again an opportunity, a counter opportunity to say this. You know, we don't want more of the things that are essential to our society in the hands of a sort of a casino system.
What was so sad in the book was how you mentioned so often in these countries they sold off their national assets for peanuts. I mean, it was like for nothing. You know, billion-dollar tin mines and copper mines for, you know, $500,000 or something.
Yeah, and because in an economic crisis, you need liquidity, right? And this is what happened in Asia in very recently, 97, 98, where they had an economic crisis very similar to what we're living through right now. And the International Monetary Fund allowed it to deepen, didn't come in with the bailout. A lot of these same Wall Street firms like J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, were saying that the name of the chapter in the book is "Let It Burn," because that what they were saying, they were saying things like what Asia needs now is more pain. And then what happened was they became so desperate for any capital whatsoever that they lowered their barriers that didn't allow foreign ownership of essential services, and these same companies, American companies and European companies, went to Asia and engaged in what the New York Times called the world's biggest going out of business sale, right? And you know, this is important to remember, just because you have. I think Americans need to be quite aware of how the hypocrisy of the U.S. response is reading in places like Asia, where you know a very recent economic crisis was greeted with just pitiless response from Washington. You know, I have a quote in my book from Greenspan saying, well, this crisis in Asia is actually part of a natural evolution to an American-style economy. So, you know, that's the way that the U.S. responded to that crisis. Mm-hmm. And now they're seeing that, oh, when it's their own companies that are in trouble, they bail them out. It's pretty politically volatile as well.
We actually have a question on that. And that links. It all links. It all links so well. Could you discuss the role?
You must be a conspiracy theorist.
Maybe.
There are no connections.
Could you discuss the role of Greenspan? See, that's totally related, right?
That's
could you
so
discuss
weird.
The role of Greenspan as Fed chair in creating contributing to the current crisis?
Ah, poor old Alan. You know, he's having a bad couple of weeks, right? Mm-hmm. There was a fantastic article in the New York Times last week re-examining Alan Greenspan's legacy, a long overdue article where it tells the story of how he resisted calls to regulate the derivatives industry and essentially believed in an honor system for this shadow banking system that by some estimates is worth $60 trillion, okay? The quote in that New York Times piece from Greenspan about why he didn't see this coming, he said that the thing he didn't account for was the dishonesty of bankers. you know, I've always relied on the honesty of bankers. so, you know, Greenspan, I think, has been taking a rightful amount of flack for inflating this bubble. He delivered a lot of bubbles, very profitable bubbles, the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble. He did it knowingly. You know, I debated him on Democracy Now! Actually a year ago, where he was very, you know, open. He thought it was worth it. You know, America needed another bubble. You know, there was a very funny piece in The Onion, America demands another bubble. But, you know, think about the timing of this. The dot-com bubble burst in 2000. The Ownership Society was declared in 2001. The Ownership Society was a policy of the Bush administration to encourage low-income and minority home ownership over any other housing policy, and the directing to the banks, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to do this kind of high-risk lending. So it wasn't just about the banks. It was an intersection between government policy and the banks. And then there was Greenspan fighting off attempts to regulate the sector. But if I could just add one thing, it was not just Greenspan, okay? At his side in these key moments were Robert Rubin, and Larry Summers. And I point this out because they're both high-level advisors right now for Barack Obama. And that's why I brought up Stiglitz. Because I think this is, it is, you know, I know we don't know what's going to happen with the election, but we do know this. Really key decisions are made about what kind of government this will be in this key period between the elections and the inauguration. And in 92, after Clinton was elected, promising job creation and reopening NAFTA, actually, to include labor and environmental standards, he had a very fateful meeting with some Wall Street heavies, including Robert Rubin. This is before inauguration, where, according to Robert Rubin, Clinton was converted to the root of economic austerity because he understood that there was a crisis. Okay, so if you read these accounts of how Greenspan fought off the attempts to regulate, it was not just Greenspan. Bob Rubin was by his side at every point. And I think it is really important. I mean, my goal is to make Bob Rubin as much of a political liability for Barack Obama as Reverend Wright. I want him thrown under the bus.
It really, you know, to get back to the Chicago West Side School of Economics, it is the crazy thing about this is this idea that you would trust people with money. I mean, you always count the money when it leaves and you count the money when it comes back. And why would there be this one group of person that doesn't need oversight? I mean, if all men are created equal and we all know people that have stolen, why would we pick this one group and say you can absolutely trust this group of people with insane amounts of money and they don't need to be regulated or watched? It's almost it's like the tragedy of trust.
This is the country's chief regulator, and you know I think that they were all a little. I guess a charitable interpretation is just that Greenspan was enamored of those, you know, key economic indicators, right? I mean, this is sort of growth above all else, right? And it doesn't measure where the growth is coming from. And what bubbles do is they, you know, your GDP is growing. And this has been the sort of divide of recent years where the Bush administration has been saying the economy is doing really, really well because according to those indicators, it's still growing. And then people are saying, well, my wages are stagnating. It's not going well for me. But I think in the 90s for Greenspan, he was, you know, he was being lauded as a genius because of those indicators. And he didn't want to do anything that would threaten that bubble. I mean, the reason these stories that are now coming out, there was one woman in particular, her last name is Bond, who was head of the Commodity Futures Exchange, who wanted to regulate the derivatives sector. She you know, what they were afraid of was that she was going to burst the bubble. You know, if word got out that they were, that the party was going to be over, then the market would panic. And certainly what we're seeing now is how very emotional these markets are, particularly because the people inside them know it's a house of cards, right? They know that they don't really understand. They know the level of leverage, you know, and this happened with the bursting of the dot-com bubble too. So there's a lot of fear of, you know, sending the wrong message to the market, and regulation is the wrong message to the market. So I suppose that could explain it a little bit.
This is an interesting question. I don't fully understand it, but I'm asking it anyway. Is the Bonoization of activism an inevitability of fundamental...
The Bonoization.
Of activism, as Bono, you too, an inevitability of fundamentalist free market capitalism or an unexpected progressive outcropping. How would you compare Bono's Red Campaign to the Millennium Promise Campaign? And are there any charitable or philanthropic models you consider particularly effective?
It's a great question. There's a lot of questions in there, but I mean, I guess...
There's one more that I didn't ask, actually.
That's not a question. That's your paper.
Four questions.
I think, I suppose what I'm a little skeptical of about the Bono phenomenon, and particularly the Product Red campaign. This is the line of products that was launched with, you know, a whole bunch of companies where a percentage of the profits went to the Global AIDS Fund. This Well, first of all, there's a lot of things to be skeptical about it. One is just that so much more money was spent on marketing it than actually went into the fund. But a significant amount did go into the fund. I guess that I do see it as the culmination of this market fundamentalism, because it's really an end run. You know, we used to have taxes for that. You know, a percentage of your wealth would go to taxes, and then they were spent in the public interest. And I'm just not sure I want to leave it to Bono and Apple and the Gap, you know, to decide. So if the choice is between nothing and that, you know, it's better. But I don't think those are the only two choices. And, you know, I think we see the volatility of it in a moment of economic downturn, because a lot of this, these market-based solutions, even market-based solutions to climate change, for instance, right, the idea of green venture capitalism, solving the climate crisis, they really are boom time ideas. That, you know, they are ideas that you know, when there's a lot of money sloshing around, corporations will use these in part because they're good tax dodges, in part because they just have more money than they know what to do with, and they will make risky investments in, you know, solar and wind, and, you know, just to see what will happen, and the Product Red campaign. What we're already seeing with the economic downturn is that the green venture capital funds are reporting much, much lower investments. I think we're going to see the same thing, unfortunately, with AIDS, which is, you know, and these issues are too important. And fundamentally, we, you know, what we have just seen with the bailout of Wall Street, or the attempted bailout of Wall Street, is a very, very activist government. And very, very activist coordinated government responses. You know, everybody under 40 in this room grew up with the idea that government is the problem, not the solution. That, you know, any problem you have, there's no solution for it. You're on your own. There's certainly no collective solution for it. There's only a market-based solution or only a charity-based model. And now we've just seen a level of activism in government that is entirely new for our lifetimes. And I think that's a real opportunity to say, wait a minute, right? If you can act with that much focus and marshal that much, that level of resources to save an insurance company like AIG, more than $100 billion, you know, that could get healthcare to every child in this country. And there is a window of opportunity to make those arguments with great confidence. And I think it's important not to wait for the crisis to get deeper and the think tanks to get more organized in making their austerity arguments and their cutback arguments, to come in there in this moment when we have just seen this and say, we are, in particular, we have to remember that the financial crisis is not the only crisis we face. The global AIDS crisis is another one. Global climate crisis is another one. And we're already starting to see the ground shift, right? Questions to Obama like, you know, would you be willing to delay your green energy programs because of the economic crisis? And we're starting to hear a little bit of hedging on his part. He needs to hear from young people in particular right now that these are non-negotiables. They're absolute non-negotiables. And that's why we have to start thinking about other revenue streams. You know, that's why I'm calling for the nationalization of Exxon at any given opportunity. And I'm only half joking, because, you know, they made $40 billion in profits last year. You know, they were one of the key creators of our climate catastrophe. We need to start thinking. You know, if we're nationalizing stuff, we should be putting everything on the table. But, you know, more importantly, I think it creates space for Obama to protect his promise to impose a windfall profit tax on the oil and gas industry. And, you know, what I've been saying to people about Obama, and I really don't think it can be said enough, you know, Obama's a centrist. And if you're worried about that, move the center. You know, that's the way you actually get political change. Get out there and make more radical arguments and let him make the compromise.
Exxon is an interesting phenomenon. You know, like, Houston has the worst recycling in the country, and Exxon, the most profitable company in the world, is based in Houston. They have a 10-year wait for recycling bins. You know, there's 25,000 people, this is true, 25,000 people in Houston on a list waiting for recycling bins. They can't recycle, not because they're not in an area, but because they don't have a bin. We had a fundraiser in San Francisco a month or two ago. We sent 276 bins to Houston. to help them recycle. But you would think a company like Exxon could just say, yeah, we'll buy the bins. It would, you know, cost $1 million. It would be nothing. It's $6 a bin. So it's, when you think about, like, this idea that the corporations are going to solve the problems and they're going to give, you know, if you can't have recycling bins in Houston, the home of Exxon, is trying to promote itself as an environmental company, then clearly something's amiss.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I know. It was right there in the New York Times. It was mind-blowing. Again, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Naomi Klein, journalist and author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. So what other country besides Spain has withstood a shock assault?
That's a reference to what happened in Spain in 2003 when they were hit with devastating terrorist attacks in the trains. And people responded with these huge demonstrations against fear, and they were in the middle of elections. They voted out their right-wing government and voted for a party promising to pull troops out of Iraq. What's interesting about that story is when Spaniards were asked why they reacted so badly when their president, José María Aznar, told them that he blamed ETA for the attacks, and then he said, this is why we're in Iraq, and he sort of did his best George Bush impersonation. And it just didn't work at all. There was just this widespread rejection. And what Spaniards said was, and this is just across the board, there were so many interviews that were done in this period, and again the response was that Aznar reminded them of Franco. So it was essentially pattern recognition, right? But more importantly, it was historical memory. And, you know, what a shock is the loss of narrative. It is an event without a narrative to explain that event. It's not just something bad and big. That's something bad and big. A shock is something bad and big that you can't explain, that you don't have a story for. It's that gap that opens up between event and narrative. And that's why it is so important when you're in the midst of a shock to talk to people. And to narrativize that event. And it's why storytellers are so important, and it's why any community with a strong historical memory tends to be more shock-resistant. I mean, one of the things I find in my research is that indigenous communities around the world tend to be very resistant to these tactics because there's a deeper historical memory of where current shocks fit into a more than 500-year history of disaster capitalism. Just to give one example of that history, that in New Orleans, I actually think that there was a lot of that historical memory, and it did make people more resistant, certainly more intellectually resistant, and made people able to identify what was going on. Whether they had the ability to fight back, that's a different story because they were scattered across the country. I actually think this country is becoming more shock resistant. And I think one of the reasons why the United States is very vulnerable to these tactics is because it's an amnesiac culture. You know, as Gore Vidal said, you know, the United States of amnesia. It's a country that makes a virtue of memorylessness. It really wages a war on memory. That is the American dream, the dream of starting over. Right? From scratch in someone else's land. It's the idea that you can escape your past. It's a really dangerous idea, I hate to say it. You know, we have the same thing in Canada, so I'm not just being anti-American, but it's, you know, it is this colonial dream of starting over, and it is a lie because there's, you know, there's no empty land out there. And one of the things that I find inspiring about the way people have responded to the bailout is that there's been a lot of pattern recognition, right? Where, you know, immediately after Paulson unveiled the plan, people were comparing it to the Patriot Act, right? An economic version of the Patriot Act. John Stewart did that great segment where he cut together Bush's speech when he addressed the nation saying, you know, if you don't give me $700 billion, you're all going to die. And basically doing the same thing where he said, you know, if we don't go into Iraq, the same thing will happen. And it was almost an identical speech. You know, what was so interesting is people trusted their instincts in that moment. They just said, this doesn't add up, buying $700 billion worth of bad debts, bringing it to Washington. We don't want to do it. And they were patronized. You know, we were patronized in every major media outlet. People just didn't understand what a good and important plan this was and how trustworthy Henry Paulson was. You know, he became like Rudy Giuliani, saving the day. Never mind that when he was at Goldman Sachs, he was one of the key people, architects of these financial, of complicated financial instruments, and took Goldman Sachs' debt from $20 billion to $100 billion in 6 years. So he's going to be buying up his own bad debts. This is something that, another thing that can't be said enough. I read that in Business Week. It's not controversial. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the point is that people's original response was right. Okay? And that was a real victory when Congress voted against that terrible bailout. No matter what the patronizing corporate media decided to say, that was a real victory. People were right. And now all the economists are saying that what's actually, what they're starting to do, which is buy equity in the banks, is a much better plan. Okay? So I thought that was a great example of shock resistance. Unfortunately, it was ignored by the Senate and then again by the Congress. And, you know, there was a real subversion of democracy in this country. It should have been left there. That should have been the end of the Paulson plan, and they should have started over, okay? What's happening now is that there was one good thing that happened in those negotiations, which is that Barney Frank and Chris Dodds managed to get a clause in there that gave the Treasury Secretary the ability to negotiate for equity in the banks. It didn't tell them he had to, but it gave them the ability. Then Gordon Brown negotiated that, and the European banks announced it, and it forced Paulson's hand to say, okay, we're going to do the same thing, okay? But they have not abandoned this terrible idea of buying up the toxic debts and handing out these crony contracts to administer it. They're just doing both. So they've got $700 billion, and we'll see if they increase that. Part of it's going to the equity buys, and part of it is going continuing down this track. There's still an election, so politicians are still unusually receptive to your opinions. And I think it's really important to tell them that that original Paulson plan should just be abandoned wholesale now that it's been discredited by the market. Remember, the market did not think that was a good idea. The market plunged after the announcement of that plan. And the real focus should be on how to get a better deal in exchange for equity, because the deal that Paulson announced with the banks is a really bad deal, 5% return. Gordon Brown got 12, okay? So, you know, one of the most striking things is this absurd narrative that's come out in the media that Paulson forced the hands of the banks, right? Made them take your money. There's something suspicious going on when 9 banks agree to a deal in an hour, in 1 hour, okay? And the reason for that is they couldn't have written a better deal themselves. And by the way, the lawyer advising the Treasury represents 7 of those 9 banks. So
you talk about
keep
pattern.
An eye on them.
You talk about pattern recognition. Are we also seeing that with Bush and McCain? Is that part of what's hurting McCain so much, right? People are finally saying, oh, you're not a maverick. You're not some guy, some rancher from Texas. You're some, you know, some rich kid from Connecticut, and you've been really bad for us for the last 8 years. And here's a guy that campaigned for you, saying he's not you. Are we seeing that? Is that what's going on?
I mean, I think there's a lot going on with McCain in terms of many things going wrong. And, you know, I think there is some pattern recognition with Palin and Bush in particular. The similarities between Palin and Bush are quite striking in terms of just that scary certainty and the appeals to God to make foreign policy and so on. But I actually think maybe there's the response to Obama in the midst of the economic crisis is more telling. You know, it's worth remembering that, you know, he was really losing before this happened, this crisis happened. And a choice was made just instantly that people would prefer to have Obama in charge in a crisis as opposed to McCain. I mean, let's remember how scared we were, you know, after the Republican National Convention. He was really gaining on Obama. And so I think that one of the things that happened, well, there's two things that are really worth remembering, just in terms of gaining that needed confidence to meet this very scary period. As soon as Obama started talking about this being essentially a referendum on the ideology of deregulation and trickle-down economics, his numbers started soaring, okay? That really resonated, and he's getting a lot of feedback. And when he's, you know, what he's doing now is he's playing both sides. He's using that rhetoric, and then he's saying, plus I just met with Bob Rubin and Larry Summers, which is a wink to Wall Street, okay? It really is that. It's saying, I'm saying some very radical things out here, but don't worry, because, you know, Bob Rubin is at Citibank. He was at Goldman Sachs. He's known as the partner with Greenspan of the deregulation era. It's a very clear message that's being sent. But I think it's exciting that his numbers started soaring when he really put the ideology on trial. The other thing is his calmness, right? It's the antithesis of these shock tactics of deepening fear. It's actually speaking to people as if they're adults, right? And that is really resonating. That our panic won't be deepened, that we won't be threatened. And that is just striking a very deep chord with people. And I think, you know, these are things that we can draw positive reinforcement from.
So stay on that positive note. What strategic effective actions do you think the engaged peace and justice movement and generally concerned citizens can take to redress our failing government, economy, and war? Addiction and war addiction in 2009, post-election?
Well, one thing, you know, is to get the arguments ready. I've laid out what the arguments are going to be, where the right is going to come back. They bought themselves insurance against an Obama presidency, and that insurance is the economic crisis. I'm not saying they did it on purpose, but they're ready to use it to say all of these things that are being promised, health care, alternative energy investment, that is not affordable. So people need to be ready with alternatives for how to afford it. And I'll tell you that the defense contractors are getting scared. They're worried that this is going to mean cutbacks to them. And I think that we should make that fear come true and say... But in general, I just think that people, I know there are people here who've been involved in organizing for Obama. There has to be a planning that starts now for the day after the election to use this moment to stay mobilized and push back against this very organized lobbying that's coming from the defense contractors, from Wall Street. We know what their agenda is. It's not mysterious. But it's, you know, what's going to happen is that we are going to be asked to sacrifice the dreams of actually moving to, a sustainable ecological model on the altar of this crisis that's been created. And there has to be a strategy for refusing that. I actually think these arguments are winnable. I think we're in a moment where they're uniquely winnable because the ideologues on the right have just broken every single one of their rules, which really weakens their hand. So it's a time to get in there and think big. I think Obama has said this to his supporters, that it's a time for big ideas. And also he said, I'm going to need you. But my worry is that the culture around the Obama campaign, and this is where I think the McCain campaign is quite right, is very much celebrity, a very much celebrity model, very much, you know, a super fan culture as opposed to an engaged citizen culture. And that has to change. But I have a lot of hope that it will.
So we're going to move to our last question now. We've reached the end of our program. Every time I talk to one of these free market fundamentalists, it's about things going wrong. They say, well, that wasn't a free market. That's not really a free market. Why can't we have a free market? Why is there ultimately no such thing as a truly free market that works perfectly?
Well, here's the thing, Stephen. I think we actually have seen a truly free market. It's the derivatives market. They did not regulate that market. And look what happened. I think we're not going to see anywhere a society where absolutely everything is governed according to those rules. But we now have seen a very large sector, this whole shadow banking sector. What happens when the government just gets out of the way and lets it regulate itself? We've seen the face of deregulation. It's suicidal. But on an individual level, there is an incredible level of self-preservation, right? These bonuses, these golden parachutes, right? I mean, all of it is sort of based on an understanding that the party is going to end. That's why you need to negotiate the golden parachute, right? That's why you need to collect these massive bonuses every year. It's a very, very short-term thinking, very, very short-term logic. And it really challenges the claim that is at the core of that market fundamentalism, that if you just allow people to pursue their narrow self-interest, you will have the greatest self-interest for the society as a whole. We are seeing the absolute indictment of that logic before our eyes. We need to get out there and make that argument. You know, we have to get in there and win this battle of ideas. We can't be afraid. And this is, you know, the reason why economic crises are useful to the right, okay, is because they're in part because they're increasingly complicated. If we think about the 30s, there was such tremendous confidence among regular workers about just the structures of power in society, the robber barons, you know, who was winning, who was losing, how that could change. And one of the things that got us into this crisis is the trust in experts, right? I mean, this is what's interesting about the investigations into Alan Greenspan and how he was able to get away with this. You hear these quotes from very top-level legislators saying, well, Alan Greenspan had this mysticism around him. Nobody wanted to challenge him, right? And it's the same thing in how these toxic debts were accumulated in these complex financial instruments that it turns out nobody understood, right? So I think what happens during an economic crisis is the experts step in and they say, trust us, we understand this. And, you know, step back, and then we all think, oh, God, it's so complicated. I don't have a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago. I don't understand, you know, mortgage-backed securities. I'm going to trust Henry Paulson. I don't know what else to do. That is such a bad call. Okay, I mean, that is literally what got us into this mess. Trusting Alan Greenspan, trusting Wall Street, just trust your gut, okay? People were right about the bailout the first time, and we'll be right again.
All right. Naomi Klein, a journalist and author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. This was so exciting for all of us today, and me in particular, but all of us. I also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Stephen Elliott, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Cool, huh?